You know what the Cold War was between Russia and the United States, don't you? You don't honestly think it had anything to do with politics, did you? It had to deal with giardiasis, actually. You see, a famous question that we asked on board examinations was, some American tourists went to Leningrad, and they came back with diarrhea. What is it? And the answer was giardiasis. Of course, the Russian students at that time had the question, some Russians went to the United States and got chronic diarrhea. What's it due to? Giardiasis. And so the whole Cold War, and you know, it was not, had nothing to do with political things whatsoever. It had to do with which country gave giardiasis to who. That's really what it was all about. I mean, that's straight scoop stuff. That's straight scoop. That's the truth. Right there. So now it's Petersburg. So you might actually see a question, you know, some American tourists went to Petersburg and got diarrhea. What did they get? Giardiasis. There you go. All right. It's kind of funny. I can remember that on my exam. I remember. I took a part one exam in 1965. That's when I took my boards. That's a long time, wasn't it? And you're probably saying, you mean you still remember that? I do. So let's teach you something here about, you know, they're into physical diagnosis quite a bit on part one, surprisingly, and that's good, I think. So the question on mitral valve prolapse deals with click and murmur, closer to S1 or closer to S2? That's the question. The answer is quite simple. It deals with preload. So if we can increase the volume of blood in the left ventricle, for whatever reason, then the click and murmur come closer to S2. Because it takes longer for all the events to get the blood out. If we decrease the amount of blood, decrease preload in the left ventricle, the click and murmur come closer to S1. So it's just something simple. I'm standing up, I have mitral valve prolapse. What's my preload versus lying down? It's less. So if there's less preload there, there's less blood in my left ventricle, what does the click and murmur come closer to? S1. Now I lie down. And you listen to my click and murmur. What's going to happen there? Well, it's going to be closer to S2 because you're increasing preload. That's the concept. But that's not what they asked. They asked, what happens to the click and murmur in anxiety? Ooh. Okay, so think. You have anxiety, what's your heart rate? It increases. So therefore, you have less time to fill up your ventricles. So therefore, what does it come closer to? S1. That was the answer. Yeah, very good. So it's the old click and murmur question. Not hard. This is aortic stenosis. Over here, you saw this slide before. Has a lot of most commons, actually, associated with it. It's the most common cause, a valvular cause of syncope with exercise and angina with exercise. That's a valvular cause. It's the most common cause of microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. We talked about that already, too. Okay? Now, remember this will be an ejection type of murmur, right second intercostal space, radiation into the neck, increases in intensity on expiration. Okay, what did I want to say about aortic stenosis? All right, let's talk about the intensity of the murmur with different positions. What do you think would increase the intensity of the murmur? In other words, make it worse, make it louder. In other words, really, really showing up the problem with opening the valve. Decreasing preload in the ventricle, would that increase the intensity of murmur or increasing? That's right. So if you decrease the amount of blood that's in the left ventricle, that decreases the intensity of the ejection murmur because there's not that much blood that has to go out through that stenotic valve. But if you're putting more blood into that left ventricle and you have to get that blood out, that's going to increase the intensity. That's very important. You want to know why? It distinguishes it from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So we're getting onto that pretty soon. All right, so that's aortic stenosis. And why would they get angina with exercise? Well, simple. What do you think the pulse feels like in aortic stenosis? Think it's strong or do you think it's diminished? It's diminished. So there's, in other words, the stroke volume's decreased, agreed? So when does your heart feel, when does your coronary arteries fill up? In diastole. So if you have less blood out there, okay, because you couldn't get it all out because it had to go through the valve, then it's less filling of the coronary arteries, and you have to feed muscle that thick, I think you can see why you get angina. So it's the most common valvular lesion of causing angina. Also, syncope with exercise, you start running, you have a decreased cardiac output because it's, you just faint. So that all makes sense. Okay, this is showing aortic regurgitation. We've already discussed it, so we don't need to really go over that again. Okay. Mitral stenosis. Let's take a look at this valve over here. Okay? See that little arrow there, that little yellow arrow? That's the opening of the mitral valve. Whoa, that ain't too big, is it? Little tiny little thing like that, okay? What do you think this big goober is over here? A clot, a thrombus. And would you agree that the left atrium looks like it's pretty dilated? Yes. Okay. So when does the murmur of mitral stenosis occur? In diastole, remember stenosis problem and opening. When is the mitral valve open? In diastole. So it's a snap and then rumble. Snap, not click, snap and rumble. Okay, remember that. Apex increases intensity on expiration. Now, what's the most common cause of mitral stenosis? Rheumatic fever. Acute rheumatic fever or repeated attacks of rheumatic fever? All right, so let's talk about the rheumatic fever. Okay, because I just noticed that my slides for rheumatic fever are not here. So I have to talk about rheumatic fever now, and I will find the slides and show them to me tomorrow. So make sure that you do see what the vegetations look like. Acute rheumatic fever, as you recall, is due to a group A beta streptococcal infection, strep pyogenase, a certain strain. Okay, usually it will occur post-pharyngitis, as opposed to post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, which should either be a pharyngitis or a skin infection. I can go either way for that one. But most of the time, rheumatic fever is from a previous tonsillitis. Now remember, when you culture the blood in patients with rheumatic fever, it's going to be negative. You're not going to be able to grow out the organism because it's not an infective endocarditis. It's an immunologic thing. And you probably learned when you studied strep about the M as in Michael, protein is the pathogenic factor of group A strep. And certain strains of group A strep in their M protein fraction have antigens in it that are similar to antigens that are in our heart and our joints and other areas of our body. So when we make antibodies against those M proteins in that group A strep, we make them, unfortunately, against our own tissue. And so we end up with it attacking our heart, attacking our joints, attacking maybe our brain in the basal ganglia area and elsewhere. And so it's called mimicry. It's called mimicry. So we're developing antibodies against our own tissue because there were similar antigens in the M protein of the bacteria. So it's all immunologic. It's all immunologic. The most common valve involved is the mitral valve, and the vegetation is sterile, and they line right along the line of closure of the valve, they line it. And embolization, usually not a big feature. And you need to know the Jones criteria for diagnosing acute rheumatic fever, because in the stem of the question, I'll describe somebody like this. It'll be a young person that had a few weeks ago a exudative tonsillitis who now presents with joint pain and swelling and dyspnea. And then they'll talk about listening to the chest. They hear bivalvular rails in the lung. They hear a pan-systolic murmur, apex, that increases in intensity on expiration, S3, S4 heart sound is present, and maybe they'll throw in a couple other features associated with Jones criteria, and then you have to figure out, well, what's the cause of it, and the answer is acute rheumatic fever. The most common symptom actually is the polyarthritis, and that's why they like this question, because they're in children, there's a very limited differential diagnosis for polyarthritis. It includes juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. It includes Henoch-Schönlein's purpura. It includes rubella, which commonly produces arthritis. And it includes acute rheumatic fever. So it gets into that differential diagnosis. But none of them that I just mentioned have problems with producing heart failure and mitral insufficiency. That was the mitral insufficiency murmur I described, as you probably know. So don't fall for it. If they ask you what's the most common valvular lesion in acute rheumatic fever, don't pick mitral stenosis. That takes 10 years of repeated attacks of rheumatic fever before you end up with a stenotic valve that looks like that, at least 10 years. So the murmur that you hear in acute rheumatic fever is mitral regurgitation. because all parts of the heart are inflamed. The pericardium is, so you get friction rubs. The myocardium is, so you get myocarditis. And the endocardium is, that's the valves with the vegetation. So all those different parts are inflamed. And so you get mitral recurrent murmurs and acute rheumatic fever. Other features that, we had the joints in the Jones criteria. We had the cardiac abnormalities. We also have erythema marginatum, these little nodular areas. Remember that picture I showed you of rheumatoid nodules on the extensive surface? They're exactly in the same place, and they're exactly the same. Rheumatoid nodules and the nodules associated with acute rheumatic fever are exactly the same. Okay, they're both immunologic diseases. That shouldn't surprise you at all. Okay, there's a skin zit called erythema marginatum. It's a little skin zit that you see. And then also, as a late manifestation, you get choreiform movements. That's called Sydenham's chorea. Actually, I had one case of acute rheumatic fever, and I missed it as an intern. It drives me crazy when I think about it, because I got all bent out of shape with the polyarthritis. Okay, and I was convinced it was Still's disease. Fever, the whole bit. I guess I must have had wax in my ears that day. I didn't hear the murmur. But when I called the pediatrician and he said, well, what do you think? I said, I think this is juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. There was silence on the other end of the phone. He said, did you listen to the heart and lungs? Like, very questioning remark. And, of course, then the blood drains out of your head. Okay. Someone's challenging my ability. Ooh. Ooh. Did you listen to the heart and lungs? Well, yeah. I said, well, did you hear anything? Well, not really. Maybe you ought to go listen again. And so I did, and this time I think I put the stethoscope in my ears. Unlike a guy named Chuck, a second-year medical student. When we were listening with the three of us, they're listening to this patient and this guy that was a god of cardiology at Temple University Medical School. He's proctoring us there. So Giordano goes first, and he describes this murmur to the guy, and then Golion goes second, and I describe it because I listened to what the other guy said. Okay. And then Chucky described it, except he didn't have his stethoscope in his ears. Still around his stupid neck. No, he's gone. Yep, it's got this and this, and it's around his neck. Now, we were laughing. We thought it was very funny, okay? But God didn't think that was funny. God did not think that was funny, this guy. And old Chucky failed. He failed. The guy didn't think that was funny. And so Chucky, I think, learned. Actually, he went into another field altogether where you don't use stethoscopes. I think he went into psychiatry in the end. Okay, he did not want to deal with stethoscopes anymore. Okay, and so poor Chucky. So I always warn my students, make sure you put your stethoscope in your ears before you write down what you had. So this time I put my stethoscope in my ears, and it was a grade 3 pan-systolic murmur, axilla, S3, S4, and bibasal areola. They missed all that crap. I don't even know what the heck was the matter with me. So then I call them back. Now what do you think? Rheumatic fever. There you go. Okay. So, and then the same patient, about 6 weeks later, comes tooling down the hall in the hospital. It's at Reading Hospital, Reading, Pennsylvania, not too far from here, actually. Excellent hospital. And I see her with a comb in her hand, and she's going like this all the time. What the heck is the matter with her? What is she doing that for? Okay. What's the matter with her? And actually, she was so embarrassed by these movements, which she couldn't control, she had to have a comb in her hand to make it look like she was going to do this. It was an amazing situation. Okay, now, this is no big deal because, you know, this is a common dance that most of you guys do. All of you have Sydenham's chorea, for crying out loud. You know what I mean? You don't need any combs. It's perfectly legitimate to have that happen to you. But anyway, so she had the whole shish kebab. They had everything except the nodules and the erythema marginatum. She didn't have that. So those are Jones criteria. You need to have a certain numbers of those things to diagnose it. On boards, they like the ASO titer, anti-streptolysin O titer, because it is a group A strep infection, and that's usually elevated. Every now and then they throw that. To date, I don't think they've really asked a whole lot on the Aschoff nodule. Remember that? those reactive histiocytes in the myocardium, call them Aschoff nodules. I haven't heard of that. I've had no student actually tell me that they had an Aschoff nodule or asked about it in relationship to rheumatic fever. I don't think they're all that interested in it because, first of all, you're going to do a myocardial biopsy to diagnose rheumatic fever. Because basically it's something that you're going to find if the patient dies. Okay, so, you know, I don't think they think that's that important. So remember, it's an immunologic disease. You're not going to culture out group A strep in the blood. Okay, and remember some of the aspects of Jones' criteria. Polyarthritis, most common carditis, subcutaneous nodules, everything from marginatum, and Sydenham's chorea. And you got it. This is looking at, in mitral stenosis, this is looking at the left atrium down through the mitral valve. And that's why, you see that looks like a fish mouth? That's why they sometimes say fish mouth appearance of the mitral valve. And you can see that right here. Another question, that's anatomy. What's the most posteriorly located chamber in your heart? Left atrium. That's why the way you can see it best is with a transesophageal ultrasound. And then beam it forward, and you can see the posteriorly located left atrium. That's a board question. And because it is posteriorly located, and it is enlarged and dilated, it oftentimes presses on the esophagus, and so you can get dysphagia for solids but not liquids. Okay. Also, it can stretch the left recurrent laryngeal nerve and produce hoarseness. That's called Ortner syndrome. Okay, so there's a little interesting anatomy relationships there too. And if they have an irregular pulse, what does that mean? Atrial fibrillation. Okay. And does it surprise you that you would get thrombuses in the left atrium at all? No, because there's a lot of stasis up there because blood is really having trouble getting through there, and so there's a lot of stasis, and that's why these things very commonly develop, and so they have to anticoagulate these patients so that these things don't happen. Isn't that a bad combo, atrial fib and a thrombus? When you picture atrial fib, is kind of like those wormy contractions there. Can you just see it's like a vibrator, and little pieces and chips of this thrombus can come off and embolize. So that's very, very common in patients with mitral stenosis. All right. What is this again? Mitral valve prolapse. Good. Okay. Golly, where did these slides come from? I must have put them out of order. I like this one for mitral valve prolapse. Look at this one. Okay. Here's this valve, and you can see it. You can see it actually being prolapsed in the atrium. See that? You know, normally, when the mitral valve, when the systole occurs, the mitral valve might maybe project that far in. But look how far into this left atrium this thing went. That's because it's so redundant. And notice the reason why this patient died here is that this chordae tendineae ruptured. That's a closed one up there. Went into acute mitral insufficiency and died. Now, that's not common in mitral valve prolapse, by the way, okay? Most of the time, it's asymptomatic, no big deal. Most common symptomatic thing is usually palpitations, okay? But that's very uncommon. Remember, what are those two genetic diseases that always have mitral valve prolapse associated with them? Marfan's and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. There was a board question that was tough on Marfan's. They clearly described the Marfan's patient. They were talking about death and stuff like that in the family. And they said this patient had died suddenly. In other words, okay, and they said, why? So you had to know it was Marfan's, okay, and then it was sudden death. You think the answer was dissecting aortic aneurysm? No. Dissections, you don't die immediately. You're going to get pain, you're going to get radiation, and then eventually maybe cardiac tamponade. So that wasn't the answer. What was the answer? It was a mitral valve prolapse because these patients have very, very serious mitral valve prolapse and conduction defects too. And so the answer, when you have a Marfan's patient that dies suddenly, the answer is mitral valve prolapse with conduction defects. So that was on the exam. Okay, is aortic stenosis again, so we don't need to go through that again. What am I doing here? Where did these things come from? I don't know what happened here. All right, tricuspid regurgitation. The one that I think you want to remember for tricuspid regurgitation is intravenous drug abuse with infective endocarditis. Okay, in terms of carcinoid heart disease, we'll talk about carcinoid syndrome when we do GI, which will be tomorrow. Now, let's just say now that in order to have carcinoid syndrome, you have to have metastasis to the liver, okay, of a carcinoid tumor. And then that serotonin in those tumor nodules gets into the hepatic vein tributaries, and then gets into the venous blood and bathes the right side of the heart, and serotonin produces a fibrous tissue response of the valves. And so you get tricuspid insufficiency, pulmonic stenosis. That's my mnemonic, TIPS. TIPS, I give tips to somebody. Okay. Tricuspid insufficiency, pulmonic stenosis are the two valvular lesions associated with carcinoid heart disease. But we'll do that again when we do GI tomorrow. All right, infective endocarditis. I'll show you the two best slides. It's either going to be this one or this one. That'll be on your boards if they're going to do infective endocarditis. So let's look at them, so make sure you get them. All right, this happens to be the mitral valve. Okay, and you can see this vegetation over here, and I think you can see that this chordae tendinei is ruptured over here, because you can see only a bit of it. So notice that the vegetations are not all along the margins of the valve. They're kind of scattered around, and they're big and bulky. Okay, you can clearly look at that little sucker sticking up there. And you can see that it's destroying the valve. So you know this is infected. Okay, so let's get some stats down here. What's the most common organism causing infective endocarditis? Actually, Strep viridans. I know you wanted to say Staph aureus, didn't you? Wrong. That's the second most common one. By the way, when you brushed your teeth this morning, you had a transient bacteremia due to Strep viridans. Did you know that? Yes, because that's a normal bacteria in the mouth. And so when you brush your teeth, you will have a little bit of that get in your bloodstream. Okay? If you have some underlying cardiac disease, okay, then you run the risk of getting bacterial endocarditis, because just brushing your teeth can cause it to get in your bloodstream. And if you have damaged valves, then even though that's relatively low virulent organism, you got damaged valves that can seed it and produce vegetations in it. Okay? So actually, Strep viridans is the most common organism. The second is Staph aureus. Now, Staph aureus can infect a normal valve or a damaged valve. Right? So those are two important stats already. Second, the most common valve involved in infective endocarditis is the mitral valve. The second most common one is the aortic valve. Third, if you're an IV drug abuser, okay, remember they're injecting into veins. The most common valve involved is tricuspid valve. The second is aortic valve. And so you'll get a murmur of tricuspid regurgitation, pan-systolic, increases in intensity on inspiration, okay? Or you can get a murmur of aortic regurgitation from damage to the aortic valve. So that would be a high-pitched diastolic blowing murmur after the second heart sound. Okay, so Staph aureus is number one for sure for IV drug abuse. Last, if you have colon cancer, we have ulcerative colitis, something where there's ulceration of the colonic mucosa. There's a unique type of infective endocarditis that has consistently been asked on exams, and that's strep bovis. Streptococcus bovis. Group D is in dog, strep, is commonly associated with diseases that produce ulceration of the colon mucosa, i.e. ulcerative colitis, or colon cancer. So if they give you a history of someone with colon cancer that clearly has infective endocarditis, then you know the organism is not Staph aureus. The organism is Streptococcus bovis. Trick question. God, we're taking all their tricks away. Don't you feel sorry for these board guys? No, I don't feel sorry at all. I hope they just really cry over this. Okay. All right. I can agree with you on that. Now let's see how your powers of observation are in this aortic valve. Well, that's the aortic valve. Doesn't it look like somebody was eating it? And then it put a hole through it there, and then... Hey, what's this thing? What's this? What's this membrane here? Hey, that's the membranous portion of your septum. Remember I told you there was a close relationship of the membranous portion of your septum with the aortic valve. Do you see how close that is? So what do you think? Why did this patient get vegetations on aortic valve? Talk to me. Because they had ventricular septal defect that was not picked up. And didn't I tell you that if you have congenital heart disease or any damage to your valves, that you have an increased risk for infective endocarditis? And that's what happened. Okay, so here's the defect right over here. That's the ventricular septal defect that somebody didn't pick up, and it caused the aortic valve to get infected and produced aortic regurgitation. Ooh. This is a great slide. That's why they put it on boards. So it's going to be one of these two. They do infective endocarditis, the mitral valve one, or it's going to be the aortic valve one with a associated VSD. Pretty cool. Let's do a couple more things. Let's see how good your powers of observation are. What is this called? Splinter hemorrhage. Let's say I say this is painful. What do you call that? Osler's nose. Let's say I say it's painless. What do you call that? Janeway's lesion. And you look in the eye and you see a coplic spot. Let's say coplic in quote. In the eye. Now you know what coplic spots and measles, right? Coplic spots and measles is red with a white center. Well, that's what Roth's spot is. Red with a white center. So that's why I call it the coplic spot of the eye. Isn't that cool? Now, what do they all have in common, aside from the fact they've seen an infective endocarditis? Splinter hemorrhages, Osler's nose, Janeway's lesions, Roth's spot, anglomerulonephritis. What do they all have in common? Type 3 hypersensitivity. All these lesions here are immune complex vasculitis, all of them. See, in the old days, we used to call it embolic disease. In other words, the vegetation's got chipped off, and those were the things producing these. No, it isn't. They're immune complexes that produce a vasculitis and produce these physical diagnostic findings. Small point, but it's a point. All right, here's another, some more vegetations here. Ooh, but these are kind of weird, aren't they? They're down here, they're over there, they're over there, they're all over the surface of the valve. This patient has a positive serum ANA diagnosis. Lehmann-Sachs endocarditis. What's the patient have? Lupus. Now, this is not the most common lesion of the heart with lupus. Pericarditis is. But this is the second most common. Kind of sounds like you went shopping, doesn't it? I went to Lehmann-Sachs to get my clothes. Okay. So notice, when you see vegetations all over the valve and down here and all that stuff, they'll give you a history for a patient that clearly has lupus, Lehmann-Sachs endocarditis. They like this. Interesting, you'd think there'd be a lot of valvular dysfunction with this, but apparently there's not a whole lot. And it's fibrinoid necrosis that's going on in there, just like it would be in rheumatic fever. Okay, the last one with vegetations is, you've seen already, these are merantic vegetations of someone that had a mucus-secreting colon cancer. Remember, that was a paraneoplastic syndrome. Now, you would not, I could pass this off if I wanted to for acute rheumatic fever, but I'd have to give you the right history for it with the polyarthritis, because rheumatic fever looks exactly like this. They have these little, tiny little vegetations that go right along the margins of the valve, okay? But this happens to be merantic endocarditis in someone with colon cancer. Oh, yes, myocarditis. Pericarditis. Listen, on board examinations, if you have an infection question and you don't know what the answer is, if a Coxsackie is put down there, that's the answer. Coxsackie I call the weird and wonderful virus. It is extremely common cause, most common cause for many, many important diseases. Try these. Most common cause of myocarditis and pericarditis is Coxsackie virus. Most common cause of viral meningitis, Coxsackie virus. Hand, foot, mouth disease, Coxsackie virus. My wife says I have that. She says my foot's in my mouth all the time. She says I have chronic disease. Herpangina, Coxsackie virus. So lots of Coxsackie virus, most commons. So the most common cause of myocarditis and pericarditis is Coxsackie virus. Now remember that guy I told you that took the exam the first day was offered on computers? He didn't know one answer. Okay, at least. He said, you know, I had a question, doctor, going on. He said it was a guy that was in heart failure, and they said they did an endomyocardial biopsy, and they said there was a lymphocytic infiltrate in there, and then they said, well, what was it due to? He said, I had no idea. The answer is Coxsackie myocarditis. To diagnose Coxsackie myocarditis, you actually do have to do a biopsy of the subendocardial tissue, and you will see a lymphocytic infiltrate, as you would expect with any virus. And that question has been on so many boards since that time, you won't believe it. Okay, so if they talk about someone that's in heart failure, they do a biopsy of the myocardium and it's got lymphocytes in it, what's the answer? Coxsackie virus myocarditis. Very good. Now let's talk about cardiomyopathies. Okay, would you agree that this heart's pretty big? Would you agree that the left ventricle looks pretty big? And even the right ventricle looks pretty big, huh? So do you think maybe this could be a question like something like this? You got a woman 6 weeks postpartum who's having dyspnea. So you do a chest x-ray, and she has this generalized cardiomegaly. The heart's huge. She's got effusions at both lung bases. Okay? What do you think she has? She has congestive cardiomyopathy. Okay? Another term for this is, dilated type of cardiomyopathy. Congestive is the best one. This is a disease of the cardiac muscle. And there are many, many causes of this. This patient had both left and right heart failure. I only gave you one of the causes of this, and that's postpartum, 6 weeks usually. Why? I don't know. Other causes, Coxsackie. If Coxsackie myocarditis doesn't go away, you're going to end up with this. This lesion right up here you see here is the most common reason for cardiac transplants in an adult, congestive cardiomyopathy. You had our little friend, Trevor, talk about cardiotoxic drugs, didn't he? Could you name a couple of them for me? Donorubicin, anything else? Tricyclics, and a whole pile of them. What do you think the heart disease is when he said they were cardiotoxic? You're looking at it. So the drug-induced cardiomyopathies are congestive cardiomyopathy. Remember we talked about the alcoholic that had the big heart? Okay, remember, what was that due to? Thiamine deficiency. That was this, congestive cardiomyopathy. So lots of things cause this, from postpartum to Coxsackie to alcohol to drugs can all produce this lesion. It's very commonly asked on boards. This picture is very common too. Now this one is their favorite. It's their favorite one. Why would this be the favorite one? Because it's the most common cause of sudden death in an athlete, young athlete. Anybody know what it is? It's hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The old term was idiopathic hypertrophic subaortic stenosis. Whoa, get relaxed, buddy. Okay. God. What is this patient? Idiopathic hypertrophic subaortic stenosis. Oh, okay. Don't you love the way Hashimoto, don't you like that sound? Hashimoto. Did you ever hear a Japanese person say Hashimoto? Ever hear that? Okay, it's like this. Hashimoto! Scares the crap out of you. You know, it's just basically you're talking it all, and they say, and the patient has Hashimoto! Oh my God, you know? You know, you're getting ready. You know, you're getting ready for some kung fu here. Hashimoto! Okay. They really get into talking. I like that. Okay? But that's one of their favorite words. Good, that got your weight. Good. All right. That wasn't any slam on any, I don't know if there's any Japanese people. That's a funny one. I had a couple in my class. They thought that was very, very funny. Okay. And I actually had an American student that could speak Japanese, and he said, you know, you're right. That's exactly the way they said it. Very guttural. Very guttural. And they do make movements like that that look kind of aggressive. All right. Do you see anything wrong with this heart? Say yes. All right. Why? Because it's pathology. Very good. Do you see the thickness of the septum? It's thicker than this. So it's an asymmetric hypertrophy. Why? Because the inner ventricular septum is thicker. Now watch this, guys. This is how blood flows here. This is the left ventricle. It's really big, isn't it? Blood is going to go right through, look at this, right through this narrow opening. Here's the area of obstruction, right there. Right through there and out the aorta. Now, what is this thing? That's the anterior leaflet of your mitral valve. See, can you see that? See, if you had aortic regurgitation and blood dripped back, what would it hit? The anterior leaflet of the mitral valve would produce Boston Flint murmur. So you may not have been really aware of that anatomic relationship, but that's not what we're talking about now. Why is this such a narrow opening? Because that's too thick. Actually, if we took a laser and just burned this all off right here, we'd have a pretty big opening there, wouldn't we? That's the way it normally is. So where is the obstruction in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? It's not at the level of the aortic valve. It's below it. And you want to know what happens and why it obstructs? It's the Venturi phenomenon. Okay? That is when things go through a narrow opening or something like that quickly, there's a negative pressure behind it. It's kind of like when your car goes by leaves. Okay? You see the car go by and all the leaves, when it goes by, it just ruffles up. That's because negative pressure's there. Well, that's what people, cyclists do, right? They go right next to each other, kind of the drag in an automobile race or bicycles. It's that principle. And so when blood, under increased force of contraction, is forced through this, the negative pressures behind it suck that anterior leaflet against that septum, and it stops the blood. And so the obstruction to blood flow is not there, it's right there. So if this is true, and it is, what could we do to make this better? To reduce the intensity of the murmur and have this person have a better cardiac output. To me, it makes sense that if we could put more blood in that ventricle, that would automatically separate away that valve from that septum. So if I could fill this up a little bit more with blood, in other words, increase preload, that would decrease the amount of obstruction here because it would pull this away a little bit more because there's more blood in here. Does that make sense? I hope so, because that's the concept that you have to get. So all those things that increase preload in this ventricle will make the intensity of the murmur less and improve this patient altogether. So I'm standing up and I have this disease. Is that good for me? No, because that would decrease preload, so I have a pretty harsh systolic murmur with that. But if you listen to my heart when I was lying down and I increased venous return to my ventricle and I increased the amount of blood in here and separated this valve a little bit away from that, would that decrease the intensity of my murmur? Yes. Would I want to give this patient digitalis for any reason? Oh, God, that'd be the worst thing, because that's going to increase the force of contraction, make it go faster and make that obstruct quicker. So I don't want to use any positive inotropic agent. How about a beta blocker? Well, that would be good. Or a calcium channel blocker. Well, that would be good, because it's going to decrease the force of contraction, right? Slow down the heart rate. That would increase preload. Those are all good things. You understand? All of these things that I said have been asked on exams. Now, let me show you why this is the most common cause a sudden death in a young athlete. If we take a section through that septum, this is what it would look like. Guys, this is not normal. This is not a normal septum. Muscles shouldn't be going this way and that way and everywhere and all that way. It should be nice and orderly. And what happens is the conduction bundles are all screwed up in there. And so they have conduction defects. You know, in the bundle of Kent, they get all kinds of weird old things. And when you have conduction defects, then you run the risk of developing V-tachy at any time and dying. And so it's the abnormal conduction system in this asymmetrically hypertrophied septum that's responsible for the sudden death. So they talk about some 16-year-old basketball player dies suddenly, and they ask you what you would expect to see at autopsy. You're going to see hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Okay. So the most common cause of sudden death in a young athlete is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Very, very good. Why? What's the mechanism? Abnormal conduction. That's correct. Good. All right. This is endocardiofibroblastosis. This is an example of restrictive cardiomyopathy. When I say restrictive, what do you think that means? Something's preventing the ventricle from filling up. Now, this happens to be the most common disease producing restricted cardiomyopathy in children, and it's called endocardial fibroblastosis, and it's the most common reason for a child needing a heart transplant, this disease right here. They don't get a transplant, they won't die, because this is very thick. Look how thick that is. It just will not fill up. Now, there's many other causes of restricted cardiomyopathy. Pompe's, you know, with the glycogen in there, or iron overload. Can do it, or amyloid in the heart. All of these can reduce restrictive cardiomyopathy. The one they like on boards most is this one, endocardial fibroblastosis. Okay. Well, that looks like a giant booger there. See that one? Actually, it is. Actually, it was the heart, and I just dug around a little bit, stuck it in there, and I call this a cardiac myxoma. Isn't that cool? No. All right. Now, I want you to look at this, because this is actually the only cardiac myxoma in all the pathology slide sets. Okay, so that means if they wanted to ask you a question on a myxoma, this would be it. They better listen up on this. It's very important. Most of these are in the left atrium, okay, 85%. 15% are on the right. They're benign. They're benign tumors. They are quite movable, actually. They're not just totally free in there. They're attached to a little stalk, but they can move a little bit. And you notice that's not too cool, because it can move over and block that orifice of the mitral valve. So suddenly, boop, you don't have any blood going into your left ventricle. Syncope. Woo. They can embolize. They're very, very soft. And little bits and pieces of them can come off, so they can embolize. And there's lots of junk inside of them. And it's constantly leaking this crap out, so they can get fever and all kinds of weirdo signs and symptoms. This is the kind of thing that the New England Journal of Medicine, what do they call those? CPCs, you know. Everything's weird, you know, and they got these deficits, you know, neurologic deficits and fever and this, and they can't kind of syncope, they can't figure it out. Okay, and then someone says, I think I should get a transesophageal ultrasound and see what's going on in the left atrium. And there it is, cardiac myxoma. Okay, so this is the most common benign tumor, primary benign tumor of the heart in adults. Now, I'm going to ask you a question, because it was asked on boards. Let's say they describe, they won't show you a picture. Let's say they describe a tumor in the heart of a kid. Okay, now what would that be? Don't pick myxoma. Rhabdomyoma. Okay, they're only halfway there. Only halfway there. Rhabdomyomas of the heart, benign tumor of the cardiac muscle, are associated with an autosomal dominant disease. Who can tell me what it is? Tuberous sclerosis. That's what they're looking for. So if they talk about a tumor in the heart in a kid, don't pick myxoma, guys. They don't occur in kids. They're usually in adults. It's a rhabdomyoma, and it would more than likely be in a child with tuberous sclerosis. Now, I'll show you some of the pathology of tuberous sclerosis on Friday. Right now, it's not the right time to do that. Almost done with cardiovascular. In fact, this is the last slide. Getting close to the end of this hour, so we'll have at least 1 hour of respiratory. That makes me happy a little bit. Let's look at this chest x-ray, please. Okay, let's look at this chest x-ray. Is it abnormal? Say yes. Why? It's pathology. Okay, all right. It's got what they call a water bottle configuration. If it is, it's a weird water bottle, but, you know, whatever. Okay, sticking out a little bit more on that side. But I can tell you this, patient has these symptoms. Has muffled heart sounds. Don't say anything until I finish entirely. Has muffled heart sounds, in other words, you can't hear anything. That doesn't mean that it's going like this. No, you just don't hear nothing. Muffled. Okay? Second, very interestingly, every time the person breathes in, the neck veins distend. That shouldn't happen. Because when you breathe in and you increase intrathoracic pressures, negative ones, the neck veins should collapse on inspiration. But on this case, they're distending on inspiration. Ooh. And so you say, wow, that is weird. And you're holding the patient's radial artery there in your hand there, you know, you're feeling the pulse. And you notice something strange. That when the patient breathes in, the neck veins distend and the magnitude of the pulse decreases. So that's strange. And so you put on a blood pressure cuff on that arm and you wait to take the blood pressure when the patient's breathing in, and lo and behold, there's a 10 milli, greater than a 10 millimeter of mercury drop in blood pressure on inspiration over other times. What's the patient have? Pericardial effusion. What's the name of that triad? Beck's triad. And what's the name of the sign? Kussmaul sign. And what was it? The drop in blood pressure greater than 10 millimeters of mercury on inspiration? Pulsus paradoxus. Why did all this crap happen? Because there's effusion. There's an effusion in the pericardial sac. Okay? And that means that the heart can't fill up because there's fluid around it. That's why you have muffled heart sounds. So when you breathe in, and blood is supposed to be sucked into your right side of your heart, it can't expand. And so the neck veins distend instead of collapse. That's a small sign. Now remember, whatever happens to the right side of the heart affects the left side of the heart, because the left side of the heart gets blood from the right side of the heart. So there's no blood going into the right side of the heart, then there's no blood going out of the left side of the heart either. So on inspiration, if blood is not going into the right side of the heart, it can't come out of the left side either, so there'll be a drop in pulse. That's called pulsus paradoxus. So you almost see these, always see these two together. Neck vein distension, drop in pulse magnitude, drop in blood pressure on inspiration usually occur together. Pulsus paradoxus, Gusmol sign together. And it means, in most cases, pericardial effusion. But that's not what they would ask you. They would ask you, what's your first step in the workup of the patient? The answer is an echocardiogram. In other words, to prove that they have fluid in there. Because you have to go and call a surgeon to do a pericardial synthesis to relieve the fluid. So this is a pericardial effusion. And what do you think it's most commonly due to? Pericarditis. What's the most common cause of pericarditis? Coxsackie. But what if this is a woman had a positive serum ANA and she had this? Then what would you say? Lupus, that's right. Lupus, exactly. As a matter of fact, they'll give you a pearl. Any young woman that has an unexplained pericardial effusion or pleural effusion has lupus until proven otherwise. Why is that? Isn't serositis, inflammation of serosal membranes, a feature of lupus, yes or no? Is pleura serosa? Yes. Is pericardium serosa? Yes. And it gets inflamed, and it's going to leak fluid, and you're going to get effusions. Don't forget that. Young woman, pericardial effusion, can't explain it, lupus. Pleural effusion, can't explain it, lupus. Very, very commonly presents like that. Now, this one here is constrictive pericarditis. In third world countries, it's TB most commonly. In this country, it is a previous cardiac surgery because they have to go through the pericardium and all that crap. Now, look at this specimen, please. Here's the heart. Here's the pericardium. Look how thick the stinking pericardium is. But notice, there's no fluid in there. So when you breathe in here, the blood's going to go into the right side of the heart, but it's going to fill up and then it's going to hit that wall. So you can't fill it totally up, and it's going to hit that wall. It makes a noise. That's called pericardial knock. So one of the key things that distinguishes a pericardial effusion from constrictive pericarditis is that you have muffled heart sounds in an effusion with no knock. And as opposed to constrictive pericarditis, where you have some filling up, but a pericardial knock, constrictive pericarditis. See all this white crap that's in this pericardium here? That's dystrophic calcification, so you probably would see that on x-ray. Okay, so we're done with cardiovascular. Probably a good time to break. And if you come back at 4, we'll start respiratory.